Thank you. Be seated. The court is pleased to announce that some students from a paralegal class at Southern Careers Institute in Austin are here today. And we are now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Duke versus Maryland Casualty.
May it please the court, Mr. David C. Turner, Jr. will present argument for petitioner. He has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Dave Turner. I represent the petitioner and plaintiff trial court, Bristol Duke, in this case. There is actually one issue before this court, and that's whether or not to overrule the 1937 case of Gidry, TEIA versus Gidry. The issue for the trial court found that in the judgment that Crystal Duke was totally incapacitated, and that was a permanent situation. The jury found that the injury occurred on October the 1st, 1988, but that the incapacity did not begin until April the 1st, 1989. The Court of Appeals reformed the judgment and found that that under 8306 section 10 that Crystal Duke lost the benefits she would have accrued from October 1st 88 until April 1, 89, saying that the time began to run for the 401 weeks on October 1st, 88.
So in essence, the question that you present to us is whether or not any employee, not just this particular woman, but any employee who suffers incapacity, not immediately, but at a time subsequent to the injury or causation type event, will have the ability to get a full 401 weeks?
Yes, sir. That's the question. I think it's limited, as I read the cases, I think it's limited to a finding of total and permanent only without any allegation regarding or without any finding of partial incapacity.
Or put another way, any employee whose incapacity begins at a date other than the date of injury, if we follow the Gidry case, will never be able to get the full amount of benefits contemplated by the statute.
Yes, sir. That's the issue presented. Quite simply put, you can conceive of circumstances where a person could be injured because of economic necessity or other reason, continue employment for 402 weeks. At that point in time, they relent to the pain. The jury could find that the incapacity did not begin until then. And in those circumstances, under the Gidry case, they would be entitled to no compensation.
Gidry has been the law for 55 years, and the legislature has not seen fit to change it. Doesn't that indicate their acquiescence?
It depends on how you read this, what the statute means, Judge. It hadn't been written on since 1963. I'm not satisfied that the courts have agreed with it. It's kind of an unusual circumstance to be presented. I don't agree with what Gidry said, quite honestly. 8306.10 refers to the six instances where a person can draw not 401 weeks, but lifetime benefits. It occurs to me, and as I read the statute, what they were saying, what the legislature was saying, perhaps poorly, what they were saying was that in no other circumstance can you draw lifetime benefits. 401 weeks is it, except in these six instances.
And I think that was a strong argument 55 years ago. The question, though, is, in the time that has passed, hasn't the legislature acquiesced in Guidry, and specifically in reenacting essentially the same provision in the new law, haven't they acquiesced in the Guidry decision?
By merely copying what is the law as it has been, but not seeing fit to change it, I don't see that that necessarily says it they acquiesce it. Perhaps it's an obscure point. Who has it has only been raised a few times in 55 years, Your Honor. Certainly that argument can be made, but I don't, in my mind, it doesn't hold water because it is not a issue that is presented on a regular basis to this court or any court. There's been one case, there has not been one last time it was written on, was 1963. I don't think that's going to be brought, that's going to bring to the legislature's attention on a regular basis, and it is an unusual situation. You look at 8306, and it says compensation should be computed from the inception date of the incapacity. They have said that. I acknowledge that you have an ambiguity.
You say we haven't written since 1963. Actually, this court has never written on it except insofar as it adopted the 1937 Commission of Appeals decision.
Yes, sir.
You're talking about the Amarillo Court of Appeals decision in 1963.
Yes, sir. That's
but as far as the question that you just had about reenactment, is it true that a decision that we would reach here would have implications under the new Workers' Compensation Act as well as under the old one? Is the
which I have no idea. I hadn't thought about it in those contexts. I just can't respond to that. Whether it would or not, I don't know. The Workers' Compensation Act makes a person give up their common law right. They have no right other than under the compact. It's supposed to be construed liberally in favor of the worker. It is a situation where a person has limited benefits, no matter how badly they're injured. It occurs to me that the court, Commission of Appeals, was just wrong, gentlemen, in their decision in 1937. It's an obscure point, hasn't been raised before, and I wish Judge Grant were here to argue my case for me. He did a much better job than I could do in his dissent. I will say to you, as Judge Grant said in the opinion, it just doesn't seem right that this should be the law. You have an opportunity here to rectify what has been wrong for 55 years. There's no doubt what the Guidry case said. I'm not trying to put some interpretation on you that's not there. I don't believe that was the intent of the legislature then. Don't believe it's the intent of the legislature now to allow something to be in the law that would permit a person not to have any compensation for an injury. And what the effect of this case is. I tried this case to a jury. I submitted the case on one issue. That is whether or not this girl was totally disabled and it was permanent. There was no partial incapacity issue submitted. You don't see that very often. In this particular case, the jury found she was totally incapacitated and it was a permanent situation. The Court of Appeals, in their majority opinion, said it's a bad law. I'll conclude with that. I'll be glad to try to answer any questions you've got.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
The court is ready for your argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Albrecht Cooper, will present argument. argument for respondent.
May it please the court, it's the defendant's position in this case that the interpretation of Section 10 of 8306 given by the Court of Appeals is one that is not only supported by the plain language of the statute, but is one that has been reaffirmed by the legislature on several occasions, most recently in 1989.
There is also one, is it not, counsel, that even the majority of the Court of Appeals, in considering this case, termed bad law.
That's right, but the majority of the Court of Appeals also said that this is a matter for the legislature.
No, didn't they say that it was bound by stare decisis there in footnote 3?
They did say that they were bound by stare decisis.
In other words, an interpretation that the Commission of Appeals adopted in 1937 in the judicial system, not the legislative system, bound them to, as they saw it, in their role as intermediate appellate judges, to continue to follow that judicial decision unless this court changed it.
And this court followed Guidry again in 1966 in the case of Employers and Reinsurance versus Holt, where this court once again in 1966 reaffirmed the decision in Guidry. This court, as well as the lower court, has an obligation to interpret the statute as written. And I think it's very interesting if you look at Section 10 compared to Section 8. Both of these two statutes were passed in 1917. Section 8 of the original insurance or workers' comp act provided for death benefits, and it had a similar provision to Section 10. Section 8 provided that a worker who was killed, that the beneficiaries could receive benefits for death for 360 weeks from the date of injury. So both Section 10 and Section 8 had almost identical provisions limiting the period of eligibility. This court, or the Commission of Appeals in Guidry in 1937, interpreted Section 10 as putting a limitation on eligibility for total and permanent payments for 400 weeks from the date of injury. 6 years later, in 1943, this court, in the Gulf Casualty versus Hart decision, interpreted Section 8. And they held, and this was a case where the worker didn't die, I believe, until like 378 weeks after the injury. And this court, following the Guidry decision, held that the Section 8 of the Workers' Comp Act put a period on the limitation for eligibility for 360 weeks from the date of injury.
Counsel, doesn't that defy reality in some cases? Isn't that irrational in some cases where an injury may occur but not manifest itself as far as any disability is concerned for 401 weeks? It's a degenerative type injury. It's slow-moving, you're injured, 402 weeks later, the injury manifests itself, you're totally and permanently disabled, and you're entitled to nothing under
Well, that
your
may
argument.
Be in a theoretical case, but we know it's not the case in this case because the plaintiff sought medical attention on
but
the
isn't
date.
That a possibility?
That is a possibility, and it was a possibility.
Is that what the legislature intended, that a person be injured and disabled and receive nothing?
Well, let's look what the legislature did with the Hart decision. After the Hart decision, where the worker died 378 weeks following the date of injury, the legislature has come back. And in 1973, the legislature changed Section 8. And the legislature changed Section 8 in 1973 to provide that on death, the beneficiaries are entitled to receive, then it was 360 weeks, but now it depends upon the relationship, so many weeks of death benefits. There is no time period on the eligibility requirement for receipt of those benefits. We know that in
1973, amendments provided for lifetime death benefits for minors until they reach their majority and for the surviving spouse for their lifetime until they remarried.
Well, there were certain benefits also in 1973 that provided for 360 weeks. And I
360-week rule was abolished in 1973 for death benefits.
I looked at the statute yesterday, Your Honor. I can't recall exactly, but I believe that there were still some statutory beneficiaries in which the limitation on the time that death benefits were received was still intact. But there was
for minors until they obtained their majority.
But there was no limitation on the period of eligibility. And in fact, if you look at the new act that was passed in 1989, there are still periods depending upon the person who is receiving the benefits, 125 weeks, I believe, in certain cases, upon which certain persons may recover benefits. But the legislature in 1989 did not carry forward any period on the limitation of eligibility. Now, you look what the legislature has done with respect to Section 10, and it's totally different. We know that in Section 10, compared to what's been done with respect to Section 8, that Guidry has been followed. It was followed in the Jones and White Commission of Appeals cases in 37, the Gunn Court of Appeals case in 56, Rogers in 63, this court in Holt in 66, and more recently by the Fisher Court of Appeals in 84. The legislature has had Section 10 before it on at least six occasions since Guidry was decided. It had it in 1947, 1957, 1969, 1973, 1981, and 1987, yet in none of those occasions did the legislature see fit to address Section 10 as it addressed Section 8.
With reference to the new act, I guess the same question to you I ask your opponent, does our decision here have implications for the new Workers' Compensation Act on this issue?
I believe it does, but I believe that the new act makes it even more clear than Section 10 as far as the interpretation given by Guidry. In fact, I believe if you read the new act, it makes it clear that the legislature is affirming this court's adoption of the Commission of Appeals decision in Guidry. Section 4.29 of Article 8308 of the new act says the employee's eligibility for temporary income benefits, impairment income benefits, and supplemental income benefits terminates on the expiration of 401 weeks from the date of injury. Their eligibility to receive these benefits terminates 401 weeks from the date of the injury. This is exactly what Guidry decided. This is exactly what this court decided in Holt. In fact, if you go to 4.31 dealing with lifetime benefits under the new act, there are certain classifications in which the worker is entitled to receive lifetime benefits, but Section D of 4.31 specifically provides that in no other case may the period of income benefits be greater than 401 weeks from the date of injury. It's our opinion that the legislature has adopted the Guidry view and in fact has even made it more clear than was originally in Section 10. We believe that the interpretation given by the Court of Appeals is supported by the plain language of the statute. It's been supported by numerous decisions of the Commission of Appeals, at least one decision of this court, several decisions of the Courts of Appeals, and more importantly, it's supported by the legislative reenactment in Section 4.29 of Article 8308 in 1989. The legislature, if they believed that there was a problem with this, certainly had a chance to correct it in 1989, and they clearly did not. In fact, they clearly extended the holding in Guidry. Now, stepping back from that, it's our position that really the court doesn't even have to reach this issue in this case, because we believe, and we raised in the Court of Appeals below, that there was factually and legally insufficient evidence to support a finding of total incapacity in this case. Now, the first point that I'd like to bring to the attention of the court is we believe that the Court of Appeals erred in applying the standard in which they reviewed the evidence in this case. And basically what the Court of Appeals did was the jury was instructed on one definition of total incapacity, and the Court of Appeals reviewed the evidence in light of a definition that was not given to the jury. And we believe that this is contrary to numerous decisions of this court and is error. The jury in this case was instructed that total incapacity doesn't mean absolute inability to perform any kind of labor, but rather means that a person is disabled from performing the usual task of a worker, not merely the usual task of any particular trade or occupation, to such an extent that she cannot get or keep employment. Now, the Court of Appeals, when they reviewed the evidence in this case, didn't apply that standard. Rather, they adopted their own definition of total incapacity, and they reviewed the evidence in light of whether or not Duke was disabled to the extent that employment at labor of the class performed when injured cannot be procured or retained. Now, the definition that was submitted by the trial court is one that's been approved on at least three occasions by this court, and is one that is contained in Volume 2 of the Pattern Jury Charges. It's the accepted definition of total incapacity. It's our belief, and we believe that this court on several occasions has held that an appellate court may not substitute its own definition in the review of the evidence, that once the court submits a definition, the trial court, and that objection is not objected to, that becomes law of the case. And it's that definition that governs the appellate court's review of the evidence as to whether or not there is sufficient evidence to support a jury's answer to that. Now, the distinction between the definitions given by the Court of Appeals and by the trial court is critical. Under the trial court's definition, the only issue was whether or not she was disabled to such an extent that she could not get and keep employment. Well, the evidence in this case is that at all times before this case went to trial, the plaintiff was employed. She was continually employed, and in fact, under certain time periods, she had two jobs. The reason that the trial or the Court of Appeals added employment at labor of the class performed was to latch on to one piece of testimony. And that was some testimony that was given by the plaintiff that she couldn't go back to her job that she had at the Golden Corral because it was more strenuous. And so they latched onto that, and that was the reason they put that definition in. We believe, however, that the Court of Appeals cannot substitute its definition, rather must use the definition that was utilized by the trial court and must review the evidence in light of that definition.
Counsel, does total and permanent preclude any type of employment, even in the face of economic necessity?
Well,
a person again, could work in pain.
Again, if you look at the definition that was submitted to the trial court, which is the one which has become law of the case, which governs the Court of Appeals determination, and which governs this court's determination, it's whether or not she is totally disabled from performing tasks, the usual task of a worker, to such an extent that she cannot get and keep employment. And if she can perform the task to the extent that she can get and keep employment, then under the definition, unobjected definition.
What does keep employment mean?
Means that she won't go to work, and to job, and because she's unable to perform the task, she's fired. And if you look at this woman's history, we know that that's not the case. If we look at the...
Fired or...
Or laid off because she could not perform the task.
Or laid off or voluntarily withdraws from it because of incapacity.
Well, let's look at the evidence that was put in by the plaintiff herself in this case. When she was when she had the slip and fall in October of 88, she was working for Pizza Hut. She testified that she left the employment of Pizza Hut to get a better job, and because they weren't giving her enough hours, she wanted to work more. She then went to the Golden Corral as a waitress, and she worked there for some 8 or 9 months. In fact, the period that the jury found that she was disabled, the starting point, April 1st of 89, was in the middle of this period of employment. She testified there that she moved to go to a new job. That was the reason she left the Golden Corral. While she was at the Golden Corral, she had a second job working for a State Farm insurance agent as part of a co-op program. When she left the Golden Corral, she went to work for the gift house at Bonham, and she worked there for 2 months. She said she left there to go to college. She then went to work immediately for Walmart, and she testified that she worked for Walmart from March of 90 to June of 90, and she left there to go to college because she was leaving the area. She testified she did not leave Walmart because of health reasons and that her supervisor would be willing to rehire if she reapplied. She thereon went to Sears, and she testified that in Sears she was let go. No explanation was given as far as why she was let go from Sears. She immediately went to employment at the county seat. She testified there she was she left there because the workers or the manager wasn't cooperating, working around her school schedule, and that was the reason she terminated her employment there. She immediately went to be employed by the Denison Herald, where she was employed up until the time of trial. In fact, there was absolutely no evidence that she could not, or the reason she left any of these jobs was because of her conditions. Now, we believe first the Court of Appeals erred in applying an incorrect standard to review this case. Second, we believe that when a correct standard is applied to this case, that there is legally insufficient evidence to support the finding of total incapacity. I've gone over the employment. The issue that was submitted to the jury by the judge was whether or not she could get and keep employment. The only evidence before the jury was that she was able to get and keep employment. In fact, she did. She was employed during the entire period from the date of injury up until the time of trial. There was no testimony that the reason she lost any of these jobs was because she was physically unable to perform the task. In fact, during certain periods, she had two jobs. Furthermore, it's our position that even under the Court of Appeals standard, you allow the Court of Appeals to substitute their own definition of total incapacity, there's still legally insufficient evidence. Under the Court of Appeals standard, it's whether or not there was evidence that she could not perform labor of the class performed when she was injured. Well, again, the closest the testimony gets to this was that she didn't or she could not go back to work at the Golden Corral because it was more physically demanding than the Pizza Hut. Well, she wasn't employed at the Golden Corral at the time of the injury. She was employed at the Pizza Hut. And we know the reason she left the Pizza Hut wasn't because of any physical injury. It was because she wanted to get more hours. They were not allowing her to work enough at the Pizza Hut in order to make as much money as she was willing to make. We believe that even under the incorrect standard review, there is legally insufficient evidence to support the Court of Appeals, rather the jury's decision, and we would ask this court to reverse the case and to render the case on that point.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much.
He read the evidence different than I did, and I tried the lawsuit. I don't know what I think. The Court of Appeals certainly, gentlemen, used a definition that was not proper. I acknowledge that. I think my best guess is that somebody didn't proofread their opinion, but don't everybody here acknowledges that that's not the definition of total incapacity. You look at the evidence in this case, there were only two witnesses. Marilyn Casualty called none. We called Crystal Duke, who was 18 years old, and tried this case, 4'11". That's the woman that he's talking about. Dr. Martin was her chiropractor who was taking care of her. He testified that she had a progressively degenerative condition. She couldn't do any work that would require her to sit or stand for long periods. Crystal also said when she was working at the Denison Herald that she couldn't lift the paper. She left Golden Corral because the trays were too heavy. Under any construction of the evidence, there is sufficient evidence to support a jury's finding of total incapacity. And Crystal also testified that it was a permanent situation, and that's sufficient to support a jury's finding of permanence. There's no evidence controverting the April 1st date of incapacity. There was no evidence. This little girl got up there and told the jury her problems. They found that she was totally incapacitated, that it was a permanent situation. Dr. Martin essentially testified the same thing. It's with the date that the incapacity began, which brings up our original point of error, was April the 1st. She was working. She'd never drawn a day of comp, hadn't drawn a day of comp to this minute. My position is that there is plenty of evidence to support a finding of total incapacity, and that's a permanent situation. The third point of error I thought was unusual, and that is that the Court of Appeals couldn't apportion one half of the cost against my client, one half of the cost against Maryland Casualty. And that's obviously under Rule 89, the rules of procedure, appellate rules of procedure, they can apportion the cost however they want to. It's within their discretion. Gentlemen, what I'm asking this court to do is to issue a judgment finding that this little girl is totally incapacitated, and that she's entitled to draw 401 weeks of compensation, and I'd ask the court to tax all the costs against Maryland Casualty. That's all I have, then.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the second argument. The court will now take another brief recess.
Now,